is that had carried the first intifada were basically gutted out. So there were no popular committees, there were no grassroots groups, etc. Because when the Palestinian Authority came in and people believed in the state as their, you know, their savior somehow, all the popular mobilizations and popular bodies were disappeared, either on their own or through the repression of the Palestinian Authority. And so the second intifada began as mass demonstrations, but it faced immense Israeli violence immediately. And there were hundreds of people killed in the first weeks, which then turned the intifada as a reaction to those to that Israeli violence. It turned Palestinians towards armed violence in the intifada. And then this spiral basically led to further demobilizing the popular classes and the grassroots groups. And so the second intifada became more of an armed resistance, in which Palestinians basically had almost no chance because the Israeli military is far more superior, and with the infrastructure of domination that it had constructed, particularly since the Oslo Accords, it had spatial domination over the West Bank and Gaza, and therefore it could easily, or not so easily, but at least it could effectively thwart the intifada. And so here we are, you know, after the year 2000, after the intifada, then there, I mean, many things happened since then. Of course, prime of which was the Palestinian elections in 2006. It was the democratic elections, it was called. And, you know, it was the Americans who wanted these elections because they didn't want Yasser Arafat, okay? And they convinced Yasser Arafat to make a position of prime minister, and to give this prime minister most of the powers that the president used to have, and to appoint Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the current president, in that position so that, you know, the person who's closer to the American line would have more power in the Palestinian Authority. So Abu Ammar did that. Then he died or was killed, no one knows exactly. And then elections happened in 2006. Now, who won in these elections? Hamas, you know, and at that time, Hillary Clinton came out and said, you know, if I had known that Hamas would win, we wouldn't have allowed these elections to happen. And it's on record. So anyway, Hamas won. The Americans didn't like it. And the problem for them was then that the position, like Hamas won the Legislative Council, which is like the parliament, which meant that they would form the government and they would hold the position of the prime minister. But the Americans had empowered the position of the prime minister over the president, and now this means that Hamas has all the power in the Palestinian Authority. So the Americans basically blocked their funding from the Palestinian Authority, and they pushed towards a coup d'etat, basically, in the West Bank and Gaza, which failed and led to a split where Hamas controls Gaza and the presidency of Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah controls the West Bank. And so this led us into an impasse where we have a split not only between the inside of Palestine 48 and the West Bank and Gaza and then the Shatat, but even between the West Bank and Gaza themselves. Then Israel did its blockade over Gaza because Hamas was ruling there, and of course with the pretext of Hamas being whatever they are gonna call it. And of course this had led to many different wars against Gaza, leading us to where we are today. Gaza has been under siege ever since, and it has been blockaded ever since. People hadn't been able to leave and come into Gaza freely. Products have not been able to move into Gaza freely. At certain points, years between 2007 and I think 2011, Israel was calculating per calorie how much each Palestinian can eat per day. So this all led us to where we are today, and yeah, I'll stop here. And sorry for this long answer.
Thank you both very much for your very thorough answers and reflecting on this question from kind of a colonial perspective, but also the very intricate and multi-layered definition of what resistance is and what it can be, specifically in the Palestinian context. And for the next question, part of me is very happy that you kind of ended on the 2006 situation with kind of wanting to implement the US democratic values and, you know, kind of pushing for these elections to happen. Because while thinking about this panel, the question came up that just to kind of level the playing field, what would it be to think of the political spectrum in Palestine and the political affiliations of the different factions of the political parties, but also the political, the resistance groups. What I mean by this is that it's important to not look at this with a Eurocentric perspective of revolution and decolonization, but also more importantly, to not see it or to see it beyond a traditional left-right divide, and how to think of this question in the specific context of Palestine. And I'm not sure who wants to take this question. Maybe Ramzi and then Faye can take a minute to breathe.
Ja, ich denke, die zentrale Frage, die wir uns stellen müssen, ist, was sind Strategien, um die Befreiung Palästinas zu erreichen? Und diese ganze Grundlage, die wir gerade gehört haben und die Entwicklung historisch, wie es dazu kam, die zeigt natürlich auch einige Schwierigkeiten auf, unterschiedlicher politischer Tendenzen. Wie kam es eigentlich zum Niedergang der PLO, zum Aufstieg der Hamas oder damals dem Ableger der Muslimbrüderschaft, der vor allem in Gaza aktiv war und darüber hinaus? Was für Fehler wurden teilweise auch in der Widerstandsbewegung gemacht? Und ich glaube, ein zentraler Punkt ist die Notwendigkeit von Unabhängigkeit und unabhängiger Organisation. Weil es wurde schon erwähnt, es gab unterschiedliche Kräfte. Zum einen Fatah, deren Führung verbunden war auch mit der palästinensischen Bourgeoisie, deren Ziel es war, sich zu integrieren in das Weltsystem des Kapitalismus und einen bürgerlichen Nationalstaat aufzubauen, der eben im Verbund steht mit anderen unterschiedlichen Akteuren, was so weit ging bis hin zur Verhandlung der Führung mit dem Imperialismus und mit dem Zionismus und zunehmender Normalisierung bis zu dem Punkt, den wir heute haben mit der palästinensischen Autonomiebehörde, die im Prinzip als Unterhändler und Zwischenhändler der israelischen Besatzung agiert und palästinensischen Widerstand auch zentral unterdrückt im Westjordanland, ausspioniert, ausliefert und so weiter und so fort. Da gibt es eine direkte Verbindung. Ich mache wieder langsamer. Ja, sorry, es ist schwer, das alles, also so eine lange Geschichte des Widerstandes in wenige Worte zu packen. Aber ich möchte kurz sagen, was meine ich mit Unabhängigkeit? Die PLO war eben ein Zusammenschluss aus mehreren Organisationen und Parteien. Wir haben Fatah gehört, die PFLP, DFLP, also der Split damals von der PFLP, der damals noch aus einer, auf einer Grundlage sich gespalten hat von der PFLP in den 60ern, als der arabische Nationalismus in die Krise kam, auf der Analyse, gibt es reaktionäre arabische Regime und fortschrittliche arabische Regime, und da die Position übernommen hat, wir sollten nicht da rein dazwischen unterteilen, und es gibt verschiedene Regime dort, die sich auch mit dem imperialistischen Weltsystem in der einen oder anderen Form auch als Pfeiler vor Ort arrangiert haben. Und das war der Ausgangspunkt. Die DFLP machte vor allem aber mit dem schwarzen September in Jordanien einen totalen Rechtsschwenk in der Frage und hat eigentlich das vorbereitet, was dann in den Oslo-Abkommen später von Fatah übernommen wurde, mit der sogenannten Illusion der Zwei-Staaten-Lösung und einem Rumpfstaat unterteilt in verschiedene Territorien und die Akzeptanz der A- und B- und C-Zonen, wie wir sie heute im zerstückelten und fragmentierten Westjordanland auch kennen, damit, dass sie eine Etappentheorie verfolgt hatten, die in der maoistischen und stalinistischen Tradition verankert war. Also Etappentheorie bedeutet, wir müssen erstmal die Bourgeoisie unterstützen in ihrem Projekt der nationalen Eigenständigkeit und der Abschüttelung von Fremdbestimmung, Und dann im zweiten Schritt können wir uns um soziale Fragen und Klassenfragen kümmern. Das Problem dabei ist, und das wurde während der ersten Intifada auch sehr ersichtlich, dass die palästinensische Bourgeoisie ab einem bestimmten Punkt dazu genötigt ist, mit verschiedenen Weltmächten, mit dem Zionismus in eine Verhandlungsposition zu geraten und die Massenmobilisierung auch ihre eigene Stellung in der Gesellschaft gefährden kann. Wenn Rätestrukturen von unten gebildet werden, wenn dieses Schattenregierung, wurde das teilweise genannt, von unten, was in den Territorien entstanden ist, mehr die Überhand übernehmen kann. Und ich denke, was auch zentral ist, dass die Führung im Exil angefangen hat, also aus in verschiedenen Golfstaaten entstanden ist und dann eben von außen es auch Konflikte gab zwischen den Organisationen, die in der Westbank und in Gaza sich entwickelt haben und den durchbürokratisierten, vor allem nach und inmitten des libanesischen Bürgerkrieges, der PLO. Und dass da Konfliktpotenzial entstanden ist zwischen Führung und einer kämpferischen Basis, die das Ganze weitertreiben wollte. Was jetzt das zentrale Element gewesen wäre, was das hätte weitertreiben können und müssen, wäre tatsächlich eine revolutionäre Organisation gewesen, die bereit ist, es mit dem Kolonialismus und dem Imperialismus auch aufzunehmen und eine Verankerung in den herstellen will, die auch wirklich die Möglichkeit haben in den unterschiedlichen Regionen. Und es gibt ein Problem bei der palästinensischen Frage. Und das ist, dass es einen Unterschied gibt zu Apartheid Südafrika beispielsweise und der Kolonisation Palästinas. In Apartheid Südafrika war die Mehrheit der Kolonisierten, 80%, erstens mal war sie die Mehrheit und zweitens mal waren sie auch die arbeitende Klasse und konnten mit Streiks und dem Stopp ihrer wahren Arbeitskraft das ganze System zum Schwanken bringen. Wir haben das während Corona viel gehört, der sogenannte systemrelevante Sektor. Also es ist systemrelevant. Und wenn die Menschen Bewusstsein entwickeln, dass wenn sie ihre Arbeit niederlegen, wenn sie aufhören zu produzieren, dass das System kollabieren kann, dann können sie eine enorme Macht und einen Druck entfalten. Im heutigen historischen Palästina, durch die Vertreibung, die systematisch vom Zionismus begangen wurde, ist es erstens ungefähr 50-50 im gesamten historischen Palästina zwischen Jordanfluss und Mittelmeer. Und zweitens wurden palästinensische ArbeiterInnen systematisch aus den Sphären der zentralen Stützpfeiler der israelischen Wirtschaft und Produktion rausgetrieben. Und das war schon vor der Staatsgründung so. Der sogenannte JNF oder vorher Colonial Fund, aber auch die sogenannte zionistische Gewerkschaft, ich sage in Anführungszeichen, Histadrut, die unterschieden hat zwischen arabischen und jüdischen Arbeitern und arabische waren nicht erlaubt in der Histadrut und die Dreierdoktrin verfolgt hat, jüdische Arbeit, jüdischer Boden, jüdische Produkte und systematisch palästinensische Produktionsstätten, Produkte, Marktstände und Boden enteignet hat und sie alle zu entfernen sozusagen aus diesen Machtzentren. Und das bringt natürlich heute Probleme, die Macht zu entfalten, alleine in Palästina. Es muss darüber hinaus überregional Massenaufstände geben. Und auch die beispielsweise die Intifada, selbst auch die zweite Intifada, trotz ihrer schnellen Militarisierung, da stimme ich total zu, hat beispielsweise in Ägypten an den Universitäten auch zu Solidaritätsbewegungen in den Studierendenprotesten geführt, die Netzwerke gebildet haben, sich organisiert haben und dann die ersten Slogans auch gegen Mubarak angefangen haben zu rufen und überging mit ihren Organisationen in die späteren Streiks in der Textilindustrie bis zum Aufstand in Ägypten 2011. Also es gibt eine Wechselwirkung zwischen dem palästinensischen Befreiungskampf und dem Kampf gegen Unterdrückung und Ausbeutung in der umliegenden Region. Und Israel fungiert als Wachhund imperialistischer Interessen, allen voran der USA, aber auch anderer westlicher Staaten und allgemein imperialistischer Kräfte in der öl- und gasreichsten Region der Welt und wird dafür massiv subventioniert. Und davon profitieren auch Teile der israelischen arbeitenden Klasse. Selbst wenn sie ausgebeutet werden, können sie Raumvergünstigungen in verschiedenen Siedlungen in der Westbank, in Ost-Jerusalem und so weiter bekommen und entwickeln ein Verhältnis auch zu der Funktion dieses Staates für den Imperialismus. Auch sie können nicht die führende Kraft sein, die Veränderung von innen bringt. Und das haben wir auch klar an beispielsweise der Demokratiebewegung gegen die sogenannte Justizreform, ne, also gegen die faschistischen und rechtsextremen Teile der zionistischen Gesellschaft und Regierung gesehen, dass es nie zur Frage hinausging, was ist eigentlich mit den unterdrückten PalästinenserInnen. Es ging immer darum, wie können wir unser siedlerkoloniales Projekt eigentlich am besten stabilisieren, am meisten davon profitieren, global noch eine Rolle spielen und deswegen diese Masse an israelischen Flaggen. Und das gilt auch für die 300.000, die jetzt auf der Straße sind. Die Kapitalzuflüsse durch verschiedene Weltmächte schaffen dieses Verhältnis. Deswegen müssen wir auf Kräfte und auf Internationalismus besonderen Wert legen, wenn es um die Befreiung Palästinas geht und wenn es um die palästinensischen Organisationen geht und deren Strategie muss es eine internationalistische sein. Sie kann sich nicht abhängig machen von verschiedenen Regimen, auch in der Region. Das ist zentral. Sie muss ihre Unabhängigkeit bewahren und wir müssen das Ganze international auch gegen den eigenen Imperialismus, der davon profitiert, unterstützen. Das ist, denke ich, die zentrale Lehre aus den Erfahrungen der Vergangenheit.
Okay, yeah, quickly. So you asked about the different political factions and the political scene in Palestine. I think what we need to understand now more than ever is that Palestine is facing, and Palestinians are facing, an existential, you know, an existential threat. And the struggle of Palestinians today is a struggle for existence, you know, for remaining on this land, for remaining, you know, on this planet even. And in the face of a genocide, much of the political differences on the resistance front disappear. And so today, we can talk about left and right, maybe. We can talk about Islamist and leftist, Marxist, etc. in Palestine. People still carry those different ideological perspectives and strategies, but it's not so meaningful as a differentiation today, because what unites all Palestinians, and especially what unites all Palestinians who are fighting this genocide and fighting the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which has been ongoing for almost 100 years, is much, much more than what divides them in ideological basis and so on. And therefore, basically getting bogged down in those differences is really to turn our eye away from what actually matters. There was one article by the author Abdel Jawad Omar, and there he says, what is more progressive than fighting for life, right? So if it's an Islamist who is fighting for life, for the existence and for the perseverance of Palestinians, and you go and say, yes, but as a leftist, you do not meet my standards of whatever, you are basically doing that at the expense of life itself. So how can you be considered a progressive? And I think we should... Thank you. We should really maintain the focus here. Not to erase any differences, not to lose our critical insights and critical analysis, but to understand what is more important, which are the primary contradictions today. And then we can, of course, analyze what goes beyond that. And we can see that in the popular consciousness of people in the West Bank, for example, and Gaza and everywhere. If you look at the emerging political structures and political bodies in the West Bank today, you can call them Gen Z, or I don't know what it's called. if you ask them, they tell you, we care less. We do not care at all for political factions. We do not care at all for factionalism. We support whoever is working on the ground towards liberation. We support whoever is working on the ground for the benefit of our people. And you can see that sometimes one of those guys, he's 18, 20, 21, he might be historically coming from a Fatah supporting family, but then he works with the Islamic Jihad because the Islamic Jihad is the political faction that is able to give him, you know, resources and support. But the belonging, the sense of belonging, the sense of purpose comes towards Palestine itself and not towards that faction. And again, this is something that you can sense in the popular consciousness of the people. And any attempts or any, you know, basically commitment to rigid political differentiations and rigid lenses that we might carry on from past times or from our abstract political thought is really not doing any favor to understanding the situation on the ground.
I will speak when I feel I have something to say, so don't worry, you will hear me.
Should we?
I don't have much to add. I think you explain it very well. I think we have here, especially in these leftist bubble, the impression that it's the ideologies that we believe in here and we identify ourselves here are applied one-to-one in the Palestinian context. And as we have heard from Ramzi and Faye, you will see that even a leftist secular organization like Fatah was established by people who were part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So these things actually disappear in the far away from the first world problem, what I like to call them, because here it becomes more about identity politics and less about what is our problem and how can we solve it. And in Palestine, people tried different things, tried the communists, tried the leftist. Ideologies and now the conversation is all about Hamas. Even though, as we just heard, Hamas is not the carrier of Palestinian resistance, and these ideologies have been based on the idea of liberation and not the idea of What I think is an ideal way to see the world. So what I want to say is in this room and in these leftist bubble, there is lack of awareness about how the reality of the people affects their political affiliation and not the other way around.
I have a question basically following up to what you two were talking about, which is basically the question of the unity and the factions, you know, so what unites Palestinians and beyond the question of the factions. And I think this is can become an important discussion, especially in light of the recent Beijing declaration on ending division and strengthening the Palestinian national unity. So the question would be, what might that mean? Because we see this coming in the news and people don't know how to interpret this. Does it have a weight, if at all? And also the other thing is when you look at the ceasefire negotiations that have been ongoing forever, one point of dispute is prisoner exchange. Who does the resistance want to get out in exchange for the hostages? So it would be also good to give a little bit of an idea of some of the people who are on that exchange list and what the release of those people might mean for the future of Palestinian leadership. also in light of the unity of those factions.
We're only talking about the declaration now.
Yes.
If we look at Palestinian society and the Palestinian political scene now, it's similar to many colonized populations. You have local resistance and you have local collaboration with the colonizer. And at this point, the Palestinian Authority is the collaborators with the colonizer. It's like the Vichy regime of Palestine. And so this is the main divide. And it's not a completely like superficial political divide. It's not only in the superstructure. It's actually also in the base, you can say, because the Palestinian Authority is supported by, you know, by a social formation which benefits materially from this structure of the Palestinian Authority, which is ruled by, you know, a small part of Fatah, not all Fatah as a party. And so there is that primary divide. Now, along its sides, if we want to talk about political factions specifically, on the side of the Palestinian Authority, you have mainly the leadership of Fatah, even though there is an opposition in Fatah as well, but it is completely demobilized to the extent that it does not form any formidable political power. And then on the other side, you have Hamas, you have the Islamic Jihad, PIJ, you have the PFLP, and you have the DFLP and Al-Mubadara and other leftist parties, which some of them are somewhat in the middle, trying to straddle between the benefits they get from the Palestinian Authority and the principles that they claim to uphold. The majority of the Palestinian population is, of course, with the resistance and in opposition of the Palestinian Authority, even though a large size of that in the West Bank specifically benefits from the Palestinian Authority, and so until now it's not ready to revolt against it or to let go of the benefits that it gains from it. And I mean, we can elaborate on all these soft and hard means of controlling the population that the Palestinian Authority uses. Now, as for the Beijing declaration, I personally think it's futile because at this point, the Palestinian Authority is not interested in any form of Palestinian cohesion because it understands that any semblance of democracy will dethrone it from power, will dethrone its elites. They don't have popular support and they don't have legitimacy either. They have basically the hard power of the security forces that they run, which are supported by Israel and funded by the Americans and the Europeans. And the hard power of those security forces, it is what is holding their rule. And anything of a power sharing with the rest of the Palestinian political body means that it would dilute their power and it would lead possibly to their overthrowing. So I'm not optimistic about that. And I think there was another part to the question.
Yeah, the other part of the question was maybe on the presumed hope of certain key political figures taking on the struggle further and
Let me reject the differentiation that you used between hostages and prisoners. Okay, this is basically playing along with Zionist propaganda. Most of the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons are taken without any trial and without any legitimate reason for their abduction.
They are hostages, yeah?
Yeah. So I think we should be careful here. Now, in terms of what are the hopes, it's difficult to say what will exactly happen, but it is obvious that when the resistance published its demands for the exchange deal and so on and the ceasefire deal, it wanted to release prime political prisoners, leadership like the PFLP general secretary and the Fatah leader Marwan Barghouti and others from Israeli prisons. And by doing so, it did want probably to intervene in the Palestinian political scene and shake it up a little bit, to also delegitimize the current Fatah leadership, which is taking hold of the Palestinian Authority. Whether this will succeed or not, no one knows, but I mean, it's obvious that no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, even or in 1 hour from now. But we can only, you know, we can only guess and try to understand the different motivations and possibilities.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think.